Hello, and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way the federal government gets things done. It's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
Welcome back to the second episode on Learning Resources v. Trump. Last episode, we explained what the court held in the case, that six justices agreed IEEPA doesn't authorize tariffs. We went through the textual analysis, which all the justices agreed was clear. This episode, we're going beyond that, because this case produced seven separate opinions that totaled 170 pages, and the disagreement isn't about whether the tariffs are lawful. Again, six justices say they're not. The disagreement is about why. So to explain why that matters, I want to try a simple comparison.
I'm just going to throw a guess out here, but we have a new analogy we're bringing into the fold.
Excellent guess. All right. We have six doctors. They all agree a patient shouldn't have surgery. So same conclusion. But when you read their charts, you realize they've got there for completely different reasons. Some think the diagnosis is wrong. Some think the surgery is too risky. Some think medication would work better.
Then it would matter which reason wins, right? Because it determines what happens with the next patient. If the reason is this diagnosis is wrong, future patients who do have the condition might still get the surgery. And that's what's happening in this case.
Yeah. Here, six justices say the tariffs are unlawful, but their reasoning splits into at least three camps. And the camp that wins determines how the court handles the next time a president claims sweeping power from an old, vaguely worded statute.
Which brings us back to the major questions doctrine.
It does. Why don't you give a quick run through for anyone who missed it?
Okay. If you recall back in season one, episodes 10 and 11, we talked about the major questions doctrine. And the basic idea was that when the executive claims a really big power, economically massive, politically controversial, historically unprecedented, courts don't just ask whether the statutory text could technically support it. They ask whether Congress clearly intended to delegate that kind of authority. And in those episodes, we identified a split within the court. There's a strong version, which treats the doctrine as a freestanding rule. Extraordinary power requires near explicit authorization, and ambiguity alone resolves the case against the government. And then there's a weak version, which says, this is just careful textualism. Reading statutory language in context, including constitutional structure, and common sense about how Congress delegates its authority.
Yes, and we said that the court still hadn't resolved which version was actually the law. And that's still true. That's where we get to seven opinions and 170 pages. So just to be really clear about the structure of the opinion, Chief Justice Roberts wrote the entire majority opinion, but not all parts commanded a majority. The textual analysis that we went through last time, that is the actual official opinion of the court. That's the one that six justices signed on to. But there are also parts of his opinion that are joined only by Gorsuch and Barrett. That's three justices, a plurality. It is not binding precedent.
So the major questions doctrine analysis isn't the holding of the case.
Yes, correct. Lower courts will probably pay attention to it, but it's not the opinion of the court. And this is a really important distinction that I think a lot of the commentary is already missing. People are calling this the major questions case. It's not. It's a textual interpretation case where three justices would have also applied the major questions doctrine. And that alone is important, but we'll get there.
Okay, so what does the plurality then say?
All right, Roberts runs through the familiar major questions doctrine factors. Is there a great deal of economic and political significance? And says that the government itself pointed to projections that the tariffs would reduce the deficit by $4 trillion and that agreements reached in reliance on the tariffs could be worth $15 trillion. Roberts observes that those stakes dwarf those of other major questions cases. The student loan forgiveness case was a mere $430 billion, and it was just $50 billion in rental protections. So this is a different order of magnitude. And then another factor is whether this is a novel exercise of old authority. Read what he said about that.
It's also telling that in IEEPA's half century of existence, no president has invoked the statute to impose any tariffs, let alone tariffs of this magnitude and scope. Presidents have, by contrast, regularly invoked IEEPA for other purposes. At the same time, they have invoked other statutes, but never IEEPA, to impose tariffs. The lack of historical precedent for IEEPA tariffs, coupled with the breadth of authority that the president now claims, is a telling indication that the tariffs extend beyond the president's legitimate reach.
So, no president has ever read IEEPA this way. They used IEEPA for sanctions. They used other statutes for tariffs. And Roberts looks at Congress's pattern of delegating tariff authority, which is always done with explicit language, with limit caps, with time limits, with procedural requirements, and contrasts that with IEEPA, which has none of those safeguards.
The government tried two escape routes, right?
Yes. First, they argued that the major questions doctrine shouldn't apply in emergency situations. And Roberts said the court had already rejected that in Biden v. Nebraska. And he adds a line from a 1950 concurrence that emergency powers tend to kindle emergencies. Next, the government tried to argue that the president has broad authority over foreign affairs, and the major questions doctrine should be relaxed in that context. Roberts says the framers gave Congress alone the tariff power, notwithstanding the obvious foreign affairs implications, so there's no reason Congress would be more willing to surrender that power just because trade involves other countries.
So there is no major questions exception to the major questions doctrine, is what Roberts is saying.
Then the court goes through everything that it did in West Virginia and Biden v. Nebraska and applies it for the first time against a Republican president. And it does so in a case involving foreign affairs and national security. If you're someone who has been defending the major questions doctrine, this opinion validates that it is a genuinely neutral principle, not a tool just for striking down Democratic regulation. It is a structural constraint on executive overreach, regardless of party.
But only three justices signed on to that part of the opinion.
Exactly. And even those three don't totally agree what it is.
Okay. When we look at the composition of the court on this case, Barrett joined the Roberts plurality, but she's only one of three.
Yes. So she joined all of it, but then she wrote separately to address what she viewed as a fundamental disagreement with Gorsuch about what the major questions doctrine actually is. And this is where that weak versus strong framework matters.
Barrett is the weak version.
Yes. Her position is that the major questions doctrine is just textualism done right. When you read a statute, you read it in context. That context includes the structure of the Constitution, which vests all legislative powers in Congress. A reasonable interpreter would expect Congress to make the big decisions itself. So when ambiguous language is claimed to authorize extraordinary power, you're skeptical. Not because of a special doctrine, but because of what the words most naturally mean in their constitutional setting.
So for Barrett, the text just doesn't support the government's claim, and the constitutional backdrop is a part of why it doesn't.
Right. So read her key passage here.
So Justice Barrett wrote, "To the extent that Justice Gorsuch also thinks the background legal conventions and constitutional structure inform the most natural reading of a statute, then we may not be very far apart. Our only disagreement may be over the level of clarity required before a particular interpretation can be deemed the most natural one. I understand Justice Gorsuch to require Congress always to speak precisely to any major power that it intends to give away. As I've said before, I think the other less obvious clues can do the trick."
So Barrett doesn't need Congress to use magic words. She just needs the best reading of the statute, all things considered, to support the government's claim. And here it doesn't. But she's worried about what happens when Gorsuch's approach meets a statute where Congress really did delegate broad power and really did intend it. And under his strong form of the rule, a court might override that congressional intent just because the delegation wasn't explicit enough.
So Justice Barrett really is a realist in this sense, right? She's looking to what was realistically expected by Congress when it was deploying its legislation, regardless of whether it used the same language over and over and over again. And she gets pretty pointed about that.
Yeah, she does. She says that if the major questions doctrine becomes the strong form version, and by that she means a rule that instructs judges to adopt an inferior but tenable reading, it would veer beyond interpretation and into policymaking. And then she quotes Scalia at him, saying, "Can we really just decree that we will interpret the laws that Congress passes to mean less or more than what they fairly say?"
That's a sitting justice quoting Scalia against a fellow conservative's version of a doctrine that conservatives have developed.
Yes. This isn't a left-right debate. It's a methodological debate within the conservatives. Barrett and Gorsuch agree on the result in this case. They've agreed on the result in every major questions decision that they've dealt with so far, but they disagree about the very nature of what they're doing, and that disagreement will matter enormously when a case comes along where the text is closer.
Okay, so if Barrett is the weak version, then Gorsuch is...
Oh, most emphatically the strong version. And his concurrence is doing two things. In the first part, he's trying to build a historical foundation for the major questions doctrine. He's trying to argue that it's really a freestanding constitutional principle. And once he does that, he goes after essentially every other justice on the court. Advisory opinions call this a Festivus concurrence, which is really great because it really is his airing of grievances with everyone who doesn't share his view, which seems to be everyone except potentially the chief.
Okay, let's start with his affirmative case.
He's trying to prove that the major questions doctrine isn't a recent invention, despite only having been explicitly used in cases starting in the Biden administration. He traces it from English corporate law in the 1700s through early American cases about municipal charters and railroad commissions. His claim is that whenever someone exercises delegated authority, the same principle applies. Ordinary powers come with a grant. Extraordinary powers require a clear statement.
So Gorsuch is doing exactly what I want my students to do on my exams, is be able to connect the pieces across different materials. But the major questions doctrine isn't a canon of statutory interpretation.
Yes. For him, it is a constitutional safeguard with centuries of pedigree. So the practical consequence is pretty stark here. Anytime the executive claims a major new power, ambiguity results against the government, period. You don't weigh the ambiguity and pick the most natural reading. The ambiguity itself is the answer.
Okay, so that's the foundation. Now, what does he do with everyone else?
So he has three fronts. In one part, he goes after the liberal justices. He walks through their dissents in every prior major questions doctrine case and essentially says, you read broad statutory language expansively when agencies you liked were claiming power, but now you read even narrowly when it's this president.
So he goes case by case to prove his point.
Yes, case by case. So in NFIB, the vaccine mandate, Kagan and Sotomayor read safe and healthful working conditions as broad enough to cover a mandate for 84 million people. In the eviction moratorium case, they read necessary to prevent the transmission of communicable diseases be broad enough to regulate landlord-tenant relationships nationwide. And in West Virginia, the best system of emission reduction was broad enough to transform the electricity grid. So then finally, in Biden v. Nebraska, waive or modify covered $430 billion in student debt cancellation. Every time they stressed the expansive language and the scope of the crisis.
And with IEPA.
So regulate importation during a declared national emergency that the president is personally tasked with responding to, and a statute where IEPA even authorizes greater restrictions. The president can prohibit imports entirely. So these were exactly the kinds of arguments he says that the liberal justices made in every prior case. He asks, if the logic worked there, why doesn't it work here?
And his answer is that they're applying the major questions doctrine without admitting it.
Yes. He maps each of their arguments onto a major questions doctrine factor. The extraordinary power, the unheralded claim, separation of power skepticism, and says they borrowed the entire framework of the major questions doctrine. They're just refusing to call it that.
Okay, so that's the liberals. Then he goes after the dissenters.
Yeah, this time it's aimed at justices who had been his allies. Kavanaugh joined the majority in West Virginia. He was part of the coalition that built the major questions doctrine into what it is. And now he dissents. He says the major questions doctrine doesn't apply here because AIPA involves foreign affairs and because the statutory text constitutes clear congressional authorization.
And Gorsuch's response is, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah. So he says, if the major questions doctrine is really a neutral principle, it applies here. The economic stakes are larger than any prior case. The power is more extraordinary. The historical precedent is thinner. Every factor that triggered the doctrine before is present now, only amplified. So he doesn't actually say the word hypocrisy, but it's pretty clear what he's getting at. Either the doctrine is a principle or it's a tool of convenience. You can't build it when the overreach comes from one side and abandon it when the overreach comes from the other.
Okay, so what does he say to Barrett?
He's more gentle, but he's still going after this fundamental disagreement that they have. As he said, Barrett says that the major questions doctrine is just careful textualism. He thinks that's not enough and that we really need a robust, enforceable rule. Barrett worries that his approach goes beyond interpretation to impose a clarity tax on Congress.
So he's fighting everyone on three fronts: the liberals for applying the major questions doctrine without admitting it, the dissenters for abandoning it when inconvenient, and Barrett for not making it strong enough.
Yes. And what makes it so striking is that Gorsuch is essentially alone. No other justice seems to totally share this full vision.
Okay. And do the liberal justices actually say they joined the textual holding but refused to apply the major questions doctrine?
Yes. Kagan is joined by Sotomayor and Jackson, and she concurs in part and concurs in the judgment. She agrees with the result. Like we said in the last episode, she is fully on board with the textual analysis, but she explicitly refuses to join the major questions doctrine part. And this is consistent. She objected to the major questions doctrine in West Virginia and Biden v. Nebraska, and she objects to it here too.
Even though it's working in her favor this time.
Yeah, and her reasoning is that she doesn't need the major questions doctrine because ordinary statutory interpretation gets her there. Regulate doesn't mean tax in ordinary usage or in any other federal statute. Congress uses the word duty when it delegates tariff authority. No president has read IEEPA this way for 50 years. For Kagan, that's enough. You don't need a special doctrine.
And she says the clear statement requirement from the prior cases was wrong even when it led to a result she agreed with.
Yeah, she says the approach used in those cases to override broad delegations were overriding delegations that Congress had actually intended. She doesn't want to validate that framework, even if it produces a result she likes in this case. And she says something else that's important. The conventional method of interpretation won't always favor or disfavor executive officials. It's going to depend on the different delegation schemes that Congress adopts. So sometimes, under her reading, ordinary textualism will strike down executive action. Sometimes it will uphold it. It just depends on the statute.
Gorsuch claims she's now a convert. What does she say to that?
Here's her footnote responding directly to Gorsuch.
Given how strong his desire for converts, I almost regret to inform him that I am not one.
So she says she's proceeding exactly as she did in the prior cases. She's looking at the language. She's looking at the statutory setting. She's using common sense about how Congress delegates. She reached different conclusions in those cases because those statutes were different. The HEROES Act really did broadly delegate waiver authority. The Clean Air Act really did broadly delegate authority over admission systems. IEEPA's text just doesn't support the tariff claim.
So where does that leave us on whether she's really applying the major questions doctrine under a different name?
If what you mean by the major questions doctrine is courts should be skeptical when the executive claims extraordinary power from vague language, Kagan's doing that here. If what you mean by the major questions doctrine is there's a heightened special standard that applies on top of ordinary interpretation, she's not. This matters because to the extent they would sign on with a major questions doctrine, they'd be signing on to the weak version, not Gorsuch's strong version. And under the weak version, it would also be consistent for them to find that delegation was fine in prior cases and not in this one. Barrett also isn't okay with a version that puts a thumb on the scale against the best reading. She just doesn't reach the same best reading in every case as the liberals.
Okay, so there was another liberal concurrence, Jackson's concurrence. What does Justice Jackson say?
Hers is really brief. She's really just adding a key dimension, and that is legislative history. She agrees with Kagan on the textual analysis, but she would also explicitly look at the House and Senate reports that accompanied IEEPA. The textualists on the court generally resist relying on committee reports, and she's just trying to flag this as an additional source of evidence pointing to the same direction. It's a supporting argument, but it's not the main event. So then on the other side, we have two dissenting opinions. The principal dissent is by Kavanaugh, and in that he's joined by Thomas and Alito. Thomas also writes separately with a distinctive originalist framework.
That's shocking, but let's start with Kavanaugh, because his defection from the major questions doctrine coalition is the real story here.
Yeah, his basic claim is this. Tariffs are a traditional and common tool to regulate importation. They always have been. When you tell someone they can regulate imports, the ordinary understanding of that phrase has included tariffs throughout American history.
And his strongest evidence for that claim?
He points to the Nixon precedent. And in 1971, Nixon imposed a 10% surcharge under the predecessor of IEEPA using virtually identical language. And a court upheld it. And IEEPA was enacted 6 years later with the same words. So his argument is Congress knew what those words had been interpreted to mean, and that's what they meant here. And then he also has the greater includes the lesser point. So read this, because this is the argument that's hardest to counter intuitively.
The plaintiffs in the court acknowledge that IEEPA authorizes the president to impose quotas or embargoes on foreign imports, meaning that the president could completely block some or all imports. But they say that IEEPA does not authorize the president to employ the lesser power of tariffs, which simply conditions imports on a payment. As they interpret the statute, the president could, for example, block all imports from China, but cannot order even a dollar tariff on goods imported from China. That approach does not make much sense.
It's rhetorically effective. The gut reaction is, that can't be right. How can you do the bigger thing but not the smaller thing?
And the majority's answer, like we talked about in the last episode, is that tariffs aren't a smaller version of an embargo.
Right. They're a totally different kind of power. An embargo controls what crosses the border. A tariff raises revenue. One is regulation, the other is taxation. There's different powers and different mechanisms.
Okay, so Kavanaugh argues the major questions doctrine doesn't apply then to foreign affairs.
Right. He says that the court has never applied the major questions doctrine in this context, and that the history of congressional trade delegations is a history of broad grants of discretionary power. But the majority reads that same history and sees something different, a Congress that carefully guards its tariff power, even when it delegates broadly in the trade space. The explicit language, the caps, the procedures, that's not Congress handing off the tariff power casually. That's Congress keeping it on a short leash.
Okay, let's turn to Justice Thomas. He joins Kavanaugh in dissent in full, but then he writes separately, as he regularly does.
Yeah, it's not really a shock to see a Thomas dissent. So his argument is fundamentally different. He focuses on the non-delegation doctrine, which we talked about in episode 3 of season 1. And that's the principle that Congress can't give away its legislative power without being sufficiently clear. Thomas says it simply doesn't apply to the tariff power as he understands it. He reasons that the non-delegation doctrine protects core legislative power, which he defines as the power to make rules that deprive people of life, liberty, or property. But the power to regulate foreign commerce, including through tariffs, is what Blackstone called a prerogative power, originally a royal power that the Constitution assigned to Congress, but that Congress could freely delegate back to the president.
Okay, so for Thomas, the separation of powers concerns that drive the majority's analysis are just misplaced because what the king was able to do.
Right. And what better guide could we use as to what our Constitution means than what the king happened to be doing at the time? So here he says that the majority is applying structural principles that don't fit in this kind of context. And if his view were adopted, it would significantly expand the permissible scope of delegations in foreign commerce and trade. But this is a solo opinion. It's really just the kind of opinion that's put out there to generate law review articles such that it could potentially resurface in the future.
Okay, so what happens next time then? The line upheld because the text was reasonably clear. Does it hold when it's closer?
That will depend on the statute. Certainly seems like the liberal justices aren't going to uphold overreach by a conservative president just to avoid validating a doctrine they've criticized. And Robert Gorsuch and Barrett aren't going to abandon the doctrine when their own side overreaches. So again, in these clear cases, we probably have 6 votes to strike down some extraordinary claim of power from vague statutory language. The reasoning will differ, the vote can't, won't. And that matters because this administration has claimed a lot of broad powers.
But Kavanaugh, Thomas, and Alito, they're not part of that convergence, and they're likely not going anywhere.
That brings us back to something we were talking about in season 1. Administrative law rules start to look different depending on who's exercising the power. Democrats hated the major questions doctrine until tariffs made them realize that maybe they didn't like unchecked executive action. Kavanaugh supported the major questions doctrine until it was pointed at his side. The doctrine's real test isn't whether it survives, it's whether it survives as a principle rather than a convenience. This case didn't resolve it, but it gave us potentially the clearest map yet of where every justice stands.
And for anyone who listens to season 1, this is why we covered what we covered.
Yes, it is. And next week, we will be back to season 2.
So that does it for today's episode on administrative remedies. Thank you for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this podcast and enjoy this episode, give us a like on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to tune in next time, where we'll continue to dive into the contours of administrative law, because remember, you can't fix what you don't understand.